Hello, everybody, and welcome to 2026. We're going to start off the year with a video that's a little over a year in the making. So just over a year ago, I was lucky enough to visit USS Kidd at her home in Baton Rouge, down in the southern part of the USA, and I was able to film aboard her. Now, why is it taken so long to release this video? Well, shortly after I recorded this video, Kidd was due to head off to the dry dock for essentially a refit. She'd been on her cradle in the river, that's the Mississippi River for those of you unaware, for quite a while. And, well, changes in the Mississippi River combined with the fact that cradle was getting quite old were not doing her any favours. So she's headed off to dry dock. She indeed has been in dry dock. She's been refitted. She's come out of dry dock with a snazzy new paint scheme, which you can see in this photo, and she's just waiting for the Mississippi River to rise to a point where she can be put back on her cradle so that the full museum at Baton Rouge can be reopened later this year. So rather than show you a ship and then go, oh yeah, by the way, she's going to be in dry dock for the best part of a year, you can't go and see her, I thought, well, I'll hold off on releasing the video until there's a reasonably clear time span, and for reference, that's going to be spring, for her to be back at Baton Rouge, where, of course, you can go and see her, which has the double advantage because, of course, I'm going to show you around some of the ship as she was back in 2024. But if you go and see her, then not only will you get to see the same physical items that I'm about to show you, but you'll get to see them in their new, snazzy, improved, de-rusted, repainted, and renovated form, which is always really cool. So, without further ado, let's go aboard the ship. So, welcome aboard USS Kidd. Now, Kidd is, of course, a Fletcher-class destroyer. There are quite a few of them around in the US, but Kidd is the one that is closest to its state as it was in World War II. And if some of these sites might look familiar to you, but you've never been to USS Kidd, well, USS Kidd was also a physical filming set for the movie Greyhound, starring Tom Hanks. So if you've seen her on screen, that'll be where it's from. Now, obviously, we're here in front of the forwardmost of five 5-inch 38 guns, all in single mountings. You've got one here, you've got the second gun super firing just behind. Then there is a sort of, but not quite, a midships gun, the third gun on the upper level, and then you've got another pair of super firing single guns all the way aft. But another thing you'll notice, just over to my right, your left, there's a twin Bofors 40mm. That's far from the only light or medium anti-aircraft gun on the ship. We're going to be seeing all of that a little bit later. Now, I've made mention in the video done on the Forrest Sherman and also an upcoming one you'll see on USS Stewart, the destroyer escort, that there's quite a steep slope up to the bow for seakeeping. Now, whilst there is a slope here on Kidd, it's not quite as severe because on a destroyer escort, obviously it's a smaller ship, there's less space, so if you want a similar freeboard, you have to slope up much quicker. And on Forrest Sherman, her superstructure is much further forward, relatively speaking, on the ship than it is for Kidd, because Kidd obviously has these two forward guns, Forrest Sherman only has the one. And so, as far as Kidd is concerned, from roughly the superstructure area, which is where the slope really starts in earnest, you've got a bit more length of the ship. So whilst you are still quite high over the water, once you get to the bow, this slope is much gentler. So let's keep going down the length of Kidd, and eventually we'll get to one of these guns where we can have a look inside and see how it all works. So here we are. We're now in the area of Mount 2. So that's just off to your left, my right. It's the super firing forward 5-inch 38. But we're going to look at that in a second. But first, I thought, let's have a look at this. So this is obviously, if you've probably seen a few of these videos before, fairly recognizable, a twin 40mm Bofors mount. Now, this one can be adjusted by hand. It's a little stiff, but hopefully you can see it moving there in the background. A bit of WD-40 ought to fix that. Now, this is an example of some of the upgrades that the Fletcher class got during its service career, because if you look at the very early basic plans of the Fletchers, well, originally they were supposed to use the quad 1.1s. Yeah, everyone thought better of that after a fairly short period of time. But having
close range anti-aircraft guns so close to the super firing 5-inch obviously wasn't originally thought of as a particularly brilliant idea, because the other thing is, of course, you've got the bridge just to my left, your right. So if this is going off, that's a lot of noise, a lot of shock waves, a lot of lead being thrown into the sky in an area where people are trying to concentrate to command the ship. But as time went on, they appreciate the air threat is very significant, especially in the Pacific, and so guns are being stuck pretty much wherever they will fit. And one of the places it turns out that you can fit guns is here. So this is the starboard mounting. Just behind me is the port side mounting. And just these two mounts alone represent actually considerably more medium anti-aircraft capability, if once you take into account how good the 40mm Bofors is, than the ship was originally designed with, period. Obviously, the 5-inch counts as heavy anti-aircraft, and 20mm and 50 cals are light anti-aircraft, at least by general rule of thumb. And of course, each of them has, in this case, a semi basket or bin to sit in. If you see some of the mounts on battleships and so forth, this would be a completely circular tub. In this case, obviously, because the 5-inch needs to move and people need to be able to access the 5-inch, it comes around and just stops here. So let's have a quick look to our left and have a look at the forward super firing 5-inch. So having turned around just 90 degrees, we're now looking at the super firing 5-inch 38 count forward. Now, of course, unlike the mounts that you'll see on battleships or even cruisers, so Salem, Massachusetts, the Iowas, Alabama, obviously not too far from here, all of those are twin mountings. These are single mountings. This means that, amongst other things, because there's less weight involved, they can be rotated much faster. They obviously weigh less, and that gives them an advantage in terms of rapid engagement. As time goes on, more and more power systems are added to them, so you get what's called RPC, remote power control, and that is why later on you'll see ships like the Sumners and the Gearings, the two successor classes to the Fletchers, they'll have three twin mounts rather than the Fletchers' five singles, which obviously gives the later ships an additional gun and takes up less of length on the ship. But in the late 30s, when the Fletchers are being designed, the way technology of the time is set up, this is actually a much more efficient usage of the space if you want to be engaging aircraft as well as ships. The exception to this rule is, of course, there are two destroyer leader classes that the US builds prior to the Fletchers in the 1930s. They do have twin 5-inch 38s, but they're supposed to be surface action only, so they don't need the more rapid speed of rotation and elevation that the dual-purpose ones do on the general US destroyers. The only thing that's mildly frustrating when you're dealing with 5-inch 38 mounts when it comes to the single ones is that you can actually tell with the twin mounts what kind of ship they're designed for, because the twin mounts vary quite a lot in weight, and one of the reasons for that is the thickness of the, well, you say armor plating, mostly really splinterproof plating on the fronts, and because those mounts are a lot more box-like, you can actually just quickly look at the thickness of that plate and go, oh, okay, this is clearly a battleship mount, or this is clearly a cruiser mount, or whatever. Whereas with the single mountings, because they're a lot more curved, which you probably can't see there, but I'll probably stick a photo in, you can't actually immediately tell exactly how thick the plating around this mount is. Which, you know, on the other hand, it's a single mount, so it's a pretty good bet you're on a destroyer if, you know, the rest of it hadn't already given it away. So let's continue. Right, so here we are in the pilot house, so otherwise known as the bridge, if you want to be colloquial about it. And this is obviously where you'll be commanding and steering the ship in rough weather, because in clear weather you'd be a level higher with better field of view. Because as you might be able to tell, whilst there is a field of view with these portholes, and they do have their own little windscreen wipers and everything, if, for example, I'm looking here, and again, hopefully I'll overlay a photo, what I can see is a little bit of the walkway outside, and the manual sighting on top of the second 5-inch mount, but I can't actually see a huge amount. I can just see basically a little bit of dead ahead. And if I incorporate the other two portholes either side of the one in the center, I can get a maybe 60-70% view of a line dead ahead of me. If there's air attacks coming in, I don't have a chance. I mean, even if I go right down here, I've maybe only got a 20-30 degree angle of view, and then you've got three portholes on either side, two in the actual superstructure, one in each door. And yeah, again, I can see a little bit, but I've got no real vision. Even if I do this, I've only got maybe a vision 100 degrees off of the front. And again, that nothing to that I can do about air attack at this stage. So that's why you'd want to have people up top normally. But here is obviously you've got the ship's wheel, and if I rotate it, it still actually rotates the rudder indicator. Then to my left here, this shows me what the rudder angle is supposed to be at. So I've got my actual rudder, which at the moment hopefully is not correct, because it indicates that the rudder is currently set about 19 degrees to port. But then I've also got a red indicator which shows where I'm steering for. So there's what I'm actually trying to get to, where the rudder is at this point. The difference is quite important. We've got our compass binnacle here. We've got another heading. I think this is probably connected to the gyro compass there. And then down here we've got our quick reference. So this is showing us that we're currently set to full ahead speed, but obviously you've got off, back at half, full, low, stop, and then ahead, one third, two thirds, standard, full, flank, and hand pulls is the last one there, and there's lights and everything there. You've got your engine room telegraph here, which locks in. You've got a little light-covered section here. You've got the engine telegraph revolutions marker here, and just here is a little bit of paper which is actually telling you what you need for certain speeds. So in terms of RPM, so 29 RPM is 3 knots. One third, and that goes all the way up to 404 RPM at flank if you want to go 35 knots. So, all nice comprehensive command station here. You've got another compass here. You've got two voice tubes. There's a warning, do not exceed a stern speed of 10 knots, about 120 RPM on both shafts, with the rudder hard over. You've got a... you've got a 1MC system here, so speaker amplifier unit. So that's for addressing the whole ship, as opposed to voice tubes, which will be connected to specific parts of the ship. And then you've got various boards and everything back here, which we can look at a little bit later. Some of them, just coming over here, we've got a chemical attack alarm, and we've got a general quarters alarm. Don't work at the moment, but they're not on yet. And then we've got another section for the 1MC here. So we've got 5-inch directors, forward engine room, sonar, open bridge, combat information center, radio central, emergency off and on. So that's your power switch, incoming volume, outgoing volume, output, etc. So it's a mixture of the old school and the new, all within a fairly confined environment. You wouldn't want to have too many people here, otherwise they start getting in each other's way. Right. So we're now on the flying bridge. So this is one level up from where we were earlier. And if you're about to comment on the rust in the comments, don't, because this is one of the reasons we're at Kid at this point, because Kid is getting ready to go into dry dock. By the time this comes out, she may actually well be in dry dock, but this is the immediate pre-dry dock state. So all of this stuff's going to get dismounted, taken off, cleaned. I'm being attacked by the local insect population, and put back into service, looking a lot better. So what exactly is this, you might ask? Well, this is one of the remote control stations for the 40mm AA guns. So obviously we saw the gun that actually this one controls, which is immediately below us just down there, but it's got a more limited field of view because it's got the 5-inch 38 and the superstructure next to it and the superstructure behind it. This up here, much better field of view. And to be honest, the gunners, whilst they can obviously manually operate and aim their mount, it's much better for them to just be focusing on pulling triggers and looking through sights and reloading the gun. Whereas up here, so obviously what you would do is stand like this and you can move it up and down. You could traverse it left or right if it wasn't locked in position. And this is, as a remotely connected to the 40mm, you can just direct your 40s from here. And of course, all of this stuff will be interdependent. So there is another station, a spotting one, just above us on the flying bridge, and there'll be other similar units like this around the ship. So if, say, this is a starboard one, if some of the directors further aft, or the remote control stations further aft, have been destroyed by kamikaze attack, strafing, whatever, this can take over and you can direct the entire starboard 40mm gun battery from it. Now, we're going to swing around 180 degrees, and you'll see another form of directing unit, but one for a much more surface-based engagement, which is also up here. Right, and then literally just spinning the camera around 180 degrees, we have one of two torpedo directors which are up here. So obviously the ship has two quintuple torpedo launchers, which we'll see a bit later on, but you know, you don't just aim them like down a bit of an iron sight on the torpedo tubes and let them loose. You need to work out where are those torpedoes going to go, because even with the guns, you're doing a degree of deflection shooting, because if you fire the gun and it's got, say, a 10-second time of flight, the ship that you're targeting is going to be 10 seconds ahead of where it is at the moment. With a torpedo that's only going 35, 45 knots, that problem gets exponentially larger. So here you have a full set of calculating devices, pretty much like a miniature version of the fire control computer for the ship's main gun. So you put in various angles. This is the gyro angle, so where you want the torpedo to actually go, and that doesn't necessarily have to correspond to where the torpedo's launched, because remember, the gyro can be set to make the torpedo turn a certain amount after it's launched. So if, for example, if we're bearing down on an enemy dead ahead, the torpedo tubes can't fire dead ahead, but maybe you can fire the torpedoes at 30 degrees off the starboard bow. And if you set the gyro and you say, right, okay, well, once you're in the water, turn 30 degrees, then you can actually fire your torpedoes dead ahead without having to turn and expose the ship to incoming fire. But in order to get all of that, you obviously have to put in your course and speed, enemy course and speed, and all of that will be plugged in, and that'll give you where you actually need to aim the torpedoes. Because, of course, if your target is dead ahead now, by the time the torpedoes reach there, let's say in this scenario we're firing our torpedoes off to the starboard side because that's where the launch happened to be pointed, but say the target is on, has come from the starboard side and is crossing to the port side, if it's dead ahead at the time of launch and you fire your torpedoes dead ahead, by the time they get there, the ship's going to be several thousand yards off to the port side. So at that point, maybe you actually want your torpedoes to turn to maybe a course of 300 instead of 00, and you that this will tell you what all of that has to be so that you can plug it in and fire. I mean, obviously in that scenario it would be better to fire your torpedoes off to port, but in the heat of the moment, if your tubes are already trained out to starboard, it's better to get torpedoes out in the water now in a situation where you're bearing down on, say, a Yamato, than to wait another 2-3 minutes before you can set everything up on the other side, by which point you may have been hit by something very large, fast and explosive. And then next to it, you've got a small telescope, which is obviously helpful for working out where the enemy is. Because even with torpedoes, which are, relatively speaking, short-range weapons, they're still going to be being launched at a target that's several miles away. So you want to make sure that you're shooting at something that is actually a hostile target. And bearing in mind that a lot of these ships will have some kind of disruptive camouflage pattern on them, that you're shooting in the right direction. Because the last thing you want to do is expend your torpedoes, because bear in mind you only have 10 of them aboard. Usually you're not going to have any reloads compared to the guns, which obviously if you miss you can fire again and again. But if you're going to let off one of your 10 torpedoes, you want it to count. The last thing you want is to send a torpedo off and then go, oh, actually, you know, that was a false bow wave. The ship's going a lot slower than we thought, and watch your torpedo race ahead and pass the bow of the ship and do nothing. So we've gone up another level still. This is pretty much the highest you can go without climbing the foremast, which those of you who've seen my video on going back and climbing New Jersey's mast, yeah, that ain't happening. This is the Mark 37 fire control unit. So this is essentially a dual purpose fire control unit for the 5-inch guns. Dual purpose as in you can use it to engage surface targets. You can also use it to engage aircraft if you need to. One thing you can't see in this, because the camera is right at the very edge of the deck here and just doesn't have a wide angle lens, is above it is a couple of radar units. So hopefully there'll be a photo appearing, probably this side, maybe this side, showing a slightly zoomed out view that I'll take from further down on the ship. But the Mark 37, as well as being a good fire control unit, you can see that it's an optical as well as a radar guided unit. It has its own range finders. And somebody's very happy with their horn, because of course they are. The main thing is that this is not just a good system, because you can get good optical fire control systems, good fire control systems generally, from a lot of different nations. But it's also a relatively easily replicable system, and the US has the capacity to manufacture it in huge numbers. So if you've been on other museum ships, you will probably recognize this system, because whilst this is the primary range finding system for Kidd, this will be the secondary battery range finding system on a battleship, on a heavy cruiser, etc., etc. And so having that commonality of parts made maintenance easy, but also just by using the same system over and over, the US could even more easily mass produce it. And so that meant that you could have more of these systems aboard individual ships than other nations might be able to put on their ships. So even if, let's say, you're in the Japanese Navy and you have a really good optical fire control system, well, that's great, but if you've got an optical fire control system for your destroyers, and you've got an optical fire control system for your cruiser secondaries, and you've got an optical fire control system for your battleship secondaries, well, those are three different optical setups, three different production lines, each of which is necessarily going to be a bit smaller, and therefore you're going to be a bit more stingy because you don't want to have to overproduce them. Whereas for the US, because they've centralized on the 5-inch 38 as the primary gun for their destroyers and the secondary gun for anything that's bigger, they can just go, yeah, we'll just make hundreds and hundreds of these things, at which point, you know, let's stick a couple of them on all our destroyers, let's stick four or five of them on all of our battleships, etc., etc. And not only does that mean, as I said, it's ease of maintenance, because when a repair ship goes out to the Western Pacific or wherever it needs to go, they can just take spare parts for this, and then you know that everybody's 5-inch guns will have some form of fire control in place. But it also means that crews being swapped in and out of different ships don't need a huge amount of retraining. So if you were a fire control man on, let's say, a New Orleans class heavy cruiser, and it's got Mark 37s installed in a refit, and then you're told, well, actually, you know what, your ship's going to go in for a 6-month refit, but we need people like you, skilled fire controlmen, we need you to go out again. Well, there's a berth open on Kidd, and you get stuck on Kidd. Well, this is exactly the same system you will have been used to. And then if you get transferred to New Jersey or Alabama or Iowa or Wisconsin, as long as you're sticking with your 5-inch guns, same system again. Now, what you can see here looking aft is two of the ship's searchlights on the left-hand side of this picture, which is actually the starboard side of the ship because we're looking aft. You can see that one has its iris fully shut, and on the right-hand side of the picture, port side of the ship, you can see this one's got its iris mostly fully open. Now, of course, these are nice big searchlights, so they can be used for all sorts of things, mostly in night surface actions, although it was learned very quickly that it's much better to rely on radar, because a searchlight gives your location away as much as it highlights the enemy, whereas radar, unless the enemy's got a radar detector, doesn't give your location away. And even if they do have a radar detector, it's much, much less of a look here, I'm here, shoot me indicator as compared to a searchlight beam. But a searchlight could have other uses. You can use it for looking for survivors in the water. You could, in theory, use it to point out an aircraft, maybe a scouting aircraft that you'd spotted on radar. You can, with these irises, also use it for long-distance signalling, because it's quite a nice, powerful thing. And when you're coming into port, you could use it to highlight where you are, you know, identify that you are a ship in a particular location. That's where you want people to know where you are via means of a light. And so because of their utility, you'll find that ships continue to carry searchlights for many, many decades afterwards. And in fact, ships still carry searchlights, even though as a communications medium, they've been mostly, but not entirely, superseded. Another thing that you can see whilst we're up here, if I just pan the camera down and to the right, there's one of the two flag bins, because we are right in front of the foremast, so this is where flag signals would be flown from. The foremast is this big grey pillar in front of us, so if I loosen the camera up, you can track all the way up. Well, not quite all the way up, but at least up to the yardarm. And we've got the fore funnel hiding there just behind the foremast from our perspective. Tighten that back up again. So we're going to proceed now a little bit further down and further back in the ship, because as I said, this is about as high as you can really get unless you want to climb this ladder you can see here just attached to the side of the foremast. And yeah, no. So we're now standing between the fore funnel, which is to my left, your right, and the aft funnel, which is to my right, your left, And this is another set of quad 40mm Bofors. There's one behind as well. And one thing you might notice that's different about these compared to a lot of 40mm Bofors you've seen around, apart from the cawing crows in the background, is that there's a radar dish on the port side 40mm mount. Now, that isn't there most of the time during World War II, but as radar technology gets smaller, fire control technology gets smaller, and again, more and more can be produced, radar technology goes from search to gunnery control for main guns to gunnery control for small guns, i.e. 5-inch, and then by the end of the war, they've got to a point where you can stick radar on for gunnery control even onto individual anti-aircraft mounts, such as this quad 40mm. Now, of course, there is a bit more weight involved to this, which means that once you've taken into account the electronics, the people to deal with the radar, the fire control systems over there to process that signal, and obviously the weight of the dish itself, all of that is going to affect the displacement and stability of a ship that wasn't really designed to have this many AA guns on board in the first place. And so in the immediate post-war environment, you actually see quite a lot of discussion in the Royal Navy, in the US Navy, etc., of how many of this kind of system do we want on board? Because this gives you huge amount of redundancy, huge amount of local control for each of your anti-aircraft guns. But it means if you have just these, you can have fewer of them because, of course, they weigh more. Whereas if you have, like we saw up front, standard 40mm mounts, you could have more of them directed by perhaps a central radar or a central director, which means more shells in the air, but perhaps less granular control. This gives you more of that granular control, but fewer shells in the air. So what balance do you have when you're trying to take out incoming attackers? And how all that adds up, as I said, is a matter of huge debate in the late 40s and early 50s. And so on some ships, you'll see them equipped almost exclusively with individual radar-directed guns, but fewer of them compared to what some World War II loadouts. Others, they'll only have a few of these and more of the regular types. And they still haven't honestly entirely resolved that debate by the time in the mid to late 50s that missiles come around and everyone suddenly jumps on those as the solution. But there's another impact of these, which is that the weight of a mount like this, which pretty much becomes a standard in the late 40s, early 50s for medium anti-aircraft guns that aren't 3-inch 50s, this kind of mount, in terms of how much space and weight it takes up, actually very heavily influences a lot of short-range self-defense surface-to-air missiles in the early Cold War. Now, I'm not sure which of the US systems, Tata, Talos, Terrier, etc., etc., was the short-range one, but I do know that, for example, the SeaCat system in the Royal Navy was explicitly designed to have the same footprint and weight profile as pretty much one of these mounts, so that they could replace them like for like. Which, when you think about how many sextuple radar-directed 40mm mounts Vanguard had, gives you a rather scary amount of missile launches if they'd chosen to refit that particular battleship. But in this case, aboard Kidd, we've got a mount here and a mount here between the funnels, but there's more guns further aft, so let's go and have a look at them. Right, so we find ourselves here. We've now transited actually only a few yards. The camera's actually sitting next to the aft funnel, and we're at one of Kidd's quintuple torpedo launchers. I think this is the only one that's left, because the other one would have been where we were with those quadruple 40 mils. Now, one of the things you'll immediately notice is we've got the classic hood that you'll be used to looking at most torpedo launchers, whether you play them with ships that have them in game or you look on plans. And then here you can see this is the hood back, so you can see the nose of the torpedo. So during World War II, this would have been a Mark 15 torpedo. So the US used three main torpedoes. The Mark 13 is a much shorter air-dropped one. The Mark 14 is the infamous problematic submarine launch one. And the Mark 15 is its close cousin, which is a slightly larger, longer range version mounted on surface warships. You would, of course, later on have the Mark 18 electric torpedo. You had the older Mark 10, which fitted on some of the smaller, older submarines. But if you're looking at surface launch torpedoes, the Mark 15 is the one that you will want. Now, as I mentioned, Kidd originally would have had two sets of launchers like this. This is the one that's left because as time went on, you had more and more weight being added by anti-aircraft guns. You needed more deck space for more anti-aircraft guns. And it's a very much a testament to the Fletcher class's superb design and utility that they were able to add so many anti-aircraft guns without compromising their torpedo launchers. And it's only right towards the very end of the war that you start to see some of them, like Kidd, sacrificing one of their launchers in exchange for yet further anti-aircraft armament, whereas a lot of smaller, older destroyers of all nations that were having to upgrade their AA guns were either having to sacrifice full-scale main battery guns or perhaps all of their torpedo armament in order to fit the necessary number of AA guns. Now, the other thing about this launcher, which you don't see on a lot of preserved torpedo launchers, but you do have here, is this thing. So we saw the torpedo directors up on the bridge wing, but this is actually the torpedo fire control station for this launcher. So the whole thing can be run by one guy in there as well. So in actual fact, once both of these are on board, you've actually got a minimum of four possible places where you can calculate torpedo launch data and control the launch from. And obviously this is nice and weatherproof, little bin on top, but not something you see on a lot of preserved launchers. You just see the launcher itself, or maybe the control systems in there will still be there, but the overall shelter will have gone. So this is a very rare thing to see. So obviously, if you are going to come down and have a look at Kidd, which you should anyway, but particularly these kinds of little traces of World War II era technology are pretty much unique to this vessel in terms of museum ships. Now, just behind this launcher, you can see another thing that's fairly unique to Kidd compared to a lot of the other preserved Fletchers, which is she still has her number 3 gun mount. So let's head still further back. Right, so we're now on the aft superstructure, and there's a few things to be seen here. Shows you how compact this design is. So you can see just ahead of us, we've got the aft funnel, then we've got our aft torpedo launcher, the remaining one. Then we've got our middle gun, number 3 mount. We've got another anti-aircraft director system here. The main mast. Now you might think, well, hang on a minute, Drake, this is a really tiny mast compared to that. But remember, that's the first mast, so that is the foremast. This is the main mast. The main mast at this point is only really carrying a few antenna. And then we have this little superstructure section here, and immediately behind us is the superfiring number 4 5-inch mount. So what I'm going to do, come out of view of the camera, and spin it around, and here, actually I'm going to move the camera, so hopefully this will be a relatively smooth transition, but probably not. Ta-da! So up here we have yet another anti-aircraft gun set, so another twin 40mm Bofors, and then as you can see just to the left there's the roof of turret mount number 4. Now, whilst we've reached the end of the centerline guns, with the exception of the number 5 gun, there are actually still quite a few anti-aircraft guns still on the ship. So we pan back round then quickly. There's a couple of twin 20 mils there. And if we come over this way, you can see there's another twin 20 mil there on the fantail, and obviously there's another corresponding one on the other side. So let's head back down the ladder and continue our tour aft. Right, so we're here at the aft fantail, and there are a few things that you might notice here. Firstly, of course, there are some twin 20mm Oerlikons for even more anti-aircraft defense, and as you can see, these ones fairly freely rotate. There are stops to them, but so these are light anti-aircraft weapons. So these have essentially, the way I define light, medium, heavy is a light anti-aircraft weapon is going to be a weapon where if you've got an incoming dive bomber or torpedo bomber, you can shoot at them. But if you're shooting at them and you're going to hit, then they have already come within their own weapons release range. You then have the medium, the 40mm Bofors, etc. Now those you can score hits on an enemy aircraft before it gets to weapons release range, depending on the weapon in question, but not too much further. And they will have started their attack run. Whereas with the 5-inch, the heavy, a heavy anti-aircraft gun, you can engage an aircraft well before it's even started its attack run. Now, the other things you'll see here, we have our depth charge rails. Now, these are slightly more complicated depth charges than the simple canisters you might see on some other ships. Now, there are two depth charge rails here, and as you can see, this one on the starboard side is fully loaded. But whilst a Fletcher class could do anti-submarine warfare work, and indeed, obviously, if you've seen Greyhound, this particular ship was doing that in that case. It's not the primary job of a fleet destroyer, because a fleet destroyer obviously has torpedoes for attacking enemy capital ships. It has anti-aircraft guns for defending the fleet against an air threat. Those are the main jobs you want a fleet destroyer to be doing, as well as obviously using its surface guns to defend against enemy destroyers and so forth. The task of specialist anti-submarine warfare hunting is best done, at least in the US Navy, by destroyer escorts, but destroyer escorts are a little bit slower than the fleet. So if you're operating with a fast carrier task force, for example, a fleet destroyer like a Fletcher is going to have to be doing that job. Hence, you have your depth charge launchers. But there are also other anti-submarine weapons on this ship, again, for that mission, if it's called for, which we're going to have a look at in a minute. But one last thing, if you come aboard the ship before she goes into dry dock, you might notice that if you've been seeing the decks in most other places are in pretty good condition. The deck here, basically from the last 5-inch gun aft, looks very heavily rusted and pitted. This is not the fault of the ship. This is actually the fault of the ship's builders, because when they've been looking through the ship's construction records, what they found is obviously most of a Fletcher is made from STS steel. Great, fantastic. For some reason, no one knows entirely why, the aft section of the ship's upper decking was made out of galvanized steel. Not even the whole run, just this aft bit. And the problem is, well, one, galvanized steel reacts really badly with salt water, and two, the standard procedure if you have things like STS steel and you have rust on it is if you can't get rid of it just with a bit of sandpaper or whatever, is to chip it away and repaint it. The problem with galvanized steel is, of course, if you chip away the rust, you're also chipping away the galvanization, which now means you just have regular steel with not a lot of rust resistance. And so this area, the rust accelerates incredibly quickly. There's not a huge amount you can do about that. But all of this will be fixed once she goes into dry dock. So let's have a look at the last bit that you'll see on the upper decks. Now, as I said, whilst a Fletcher class was not primarily designed for anti-submarine warfare, she was entirely capable of doing so, and, you know, as mentioned, there would be scenarios where you wanted to do so. And for that purpose, you don't just have the depth charge launchers at the back, because the depth charge launchers aft are great. You've got lots of depth charges, you can keep chucking them off. The depth charges are quite powerful. Unlike a Hedgehog, you don't need a direct hit, but the sonars can see forward. So if you're approaching a target, you need to be approaching it, you know, from bow on, but to drop the depth charges aft, that means you've got to let the submarine pass through a dead zone, which is a little bit forward of the ship, then the whole length of the ship, and a Fletcher is not a short vessel, and then you've got to chuck the depth charges off, and then they've got to sink, and then they'll hopefully detonate. So that's a lot of time for a U-boat to make course changes and so on and so forth that might make it safe. And of course, you don't have sonar contact that entire time, which is going to be a bit of a problem if it does change course. This is part of the solution that helps mitigate that. These are K guns, so we've got one here, a second one there, a third one there. And what these do is, with a small black powder charge, they can catapult these depth charges over the side. Now, obviously, that massively reduces the distance between your loss of sonar contact and when you can fire the depth charges. And indeed, it also offers you the option of, if you, say, have a sonar contact ahead at 500 yards, you can put the ship's wheel hard over, bring your starboard or port side into view, fire your depth charges, and then swing the bow back around and hopefully reacquire the target relatively quickly. And of course, just generally speaking, it gives you now roughly a 270 degree arc to cover for anti-submarine warfare, as opposed to just directly aft with the depth charge launchers, because although the K guns are fixed in position, you can of course maneuver the ship a little bit. The kid does not have a forward-firing Hedgehog launcher like full dedicated anti-submarine escorts would do, but that's largely because, as you were seeing on the bow, there isn't really the space for one. You'd have to sacrifice a 5-inch gun or something like that to fit one in, which, given all the other things the Fletcher has to do, is not really going to be an option. The other thing that you might be able to see in this shot, maybe not, slightly further down ahead of the K-guns, is a couple more 20mm installations, more like anti-aircraft guns. And of course, during her life in World War II, Kidd had a variety of different light and medium anti-aircraft gun fits. So this is just one of the fits that she had during the war, towards the end of the war.
Now, normally, since we've reached the stern of the ship, that would be the end of the tour. However, the crew were kind enough to show us some of the workings of one of the 5-inch mounts, how to load it, how to move it, etc. So we're going to see that very briefly And then if you tune in on Friday, at the time of this video being released, there's also a special interview about the ship and the museum in the current era. So let's see how the 5-inch gun can be loaded and how it can work.
Bring it back up. There you go. If you don't bring it back up, it'll slap you silly.
Gotcha.
Drop it.
Hey, I've just thought of a solution for that annoying passing barge.
We have not talked about that whatsoever in the slightest.
You can actually move a full manual, move it fully manually.
I can still do it, but the lack of grip on the right hand compromises me a little bit, but I still can do it.
Oh, that's good.
All right, you want to jump out and catch him?
Okay, whenever you're ready.
Ready? Okay, go ahead. Reset at 15.
Excellent.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.